Where did the boomers come from? How were they made? This will be the topic of today's episode.
The suburbs. Almost as much written about as Madison Avenue. And just as much in need of reflection. Like Madison Avenue, life in the suburbs has its good moments and others not so good.
Oh, no!
Discouraged? Disgruntled? Heck no. They're glad to be here. Remember?
This little clip of what life was like before the suburbs is interesting. The film is referring to the poor conditions of inner city housing stock in the 1940s after the Great Depression and World War II. I'm showing you clips now from another archival film, this one made in 1948, which shows the living conditions in Philadelphia around that time. Rather than rehabilitate these areas, it seems that a lot of American cities instituted rent controls. Indeed, this very film was made by the Welfare Board to promote quote-unquote affordable housing. You can see here the sorts of people who were left to the inner cities and why the pull to move to the suburbs became greater as we moved into the 1950s. Government policies in this era, like rent controls as well as social housing projects, retarded construction and investment and turned a lot of inner cities into virtual slum areas, as you are seeing here. Private developers instead bought large lots of cheap land in the middle of nowhere, often in deals with the local governments at state or county level. And then they tried to lure away reasonably well-to-do young families to these new developments. They built cheap, identikit housing, and then a car drive away out of town malls. And this is what we'll be exploring in the rest of the film.
Soon to absorb its familiar sounds. These are what Red Book means by its young adults. People in a certain living situation with particular interests and particular goals.
Now let me just note here who we are looking at. The adults you are seeing are members of the Silent Generation, born between 1928 and 1945. The men would mostly have been too young to serve in the war. And this film was made in 1957, when the Silent Generation were coming of age. Their parents, the Greatest Generation, or the GI Generation, who had fought World War II, were now middle-aged and in all the key seat power. It is the children you are seeing in these scenes who are the boomers. Now, the interesting thing about the Silent Generation, as we'll see as this film progresses, is that they were generally very cooperative and compliant with the older generation. They were happy to help, so to speak. And one way of interpreting what we are seeing is, to some extent, the Silent Generation fitting into a new picture of life painted for them by the Greatest Generation, who were very paternalistic and in some ways overprotective of their kids. The Silent Generation seemed to be playing out predetermined roles that have been set for them by their parents. There's a relentless drive in this film towards homogenization and conformity, following rules, and to an extent, purchasing an identikit personality and lifestyle marked by ease and comfort. From the point of view of the Greatest Generation, who had known hardship in the Great Depression and the horrors of war, all of this looked very attractive. The silent generation, meanwhile, were eager to please their parents and to play their role in this new picture. They must have had some residual memory of how things used to be, the hard times, so to speak. But note the boomers. They were also part of this picture. They were born into it. They had no memory whatsoever of what preceded this. This was the only world they knew.
School construction, we were talking about that all the time. I think that when they build the schools, you can play.
I rather have only big auditoriums.
You don't educate by an auditorium. It's amazing you can have those.
What are you talking about?
I always know how my children behave.
That's good.
What do you notice? The little boy who drops the cigarette ash on the floor is not told off by any of the adults in the room. No one seems to care about what he's done. Why would they, when they have an automated vacuum cleaner that makes it so easy to clean up the mess? That is the messaging of this little scene. Nothing is too hard in the new modern way of life. Drop cigarette ash on the floor, no problem. Your mother will just hoover it up in a jiffy. And so we see a pivotal little moment in the life of the young boomer here, in which he is taught that there are, in fact, no consequences to his actions. He can quite literally mess up and hold no responsibility for what he's done because his parents will take care of it. So the young boomer, much like his parents of the silent generation were, is overprotected, but now it goes a step further. He is also indulged.
So hardly realizing it, they come into their purchasing stage and are off on a wild, non-stop ride. A happy-go-spending world, reflected in the windows of the suburban shopping centers where they go to buy.
In 1957, the tone of the narrator is so optimistic. These new developments seemed futuristic, almost utopian. There's so much upwards momentum and hope in the air. At one point, we are shown a shot of a rocket, and the narrator voices hopes of reaching the moon one day. Everything is new and modern. Leave the past behind. Embrace the new technologies. Embrace the shiny new gadgets. The mall is not seen as soulless or empty. The mass production lines are not seen as homogenizing. Rather, all of this is interpreted as making life easier and more comfortable, as eliminating unnecessary hardship. It's that old Thomas Sowell question. Compared to what, that you have to keep in mind. And the makers of this film knew a harder life, even if the boomers who grew up in this era did not. But it is also not difficult watching these scenes to understand why the boomers themselves started to react against all of this conformism, why they longed for some sense of individuality, why they felt something was missing. Thus far in this series, I've been very critical of the boomers for their shallow selfishness and their endlessly narcissistic self-indulgence. But now imagine growing up in a faceless suburb with this plastic hollow mall as your only real outlet or entertainment beyond the television set. Maybe you too might long to travel to India to find yourself, or to reject the man. Man. Thank you.
Like the rest of life in suburbia, shopping has a family flavor.
Do you remember what size you bought?
Five.
Then we bought a tree to go with.
Yes, that looks pretty nice.
Shall we take it?
These busy families make the shopping centers look young and colorful. They have a let's go see quality that brings crowds to community events and promotions. For the children, whom the young adults have always at hand, there's plenty to do and see. While his family shops, a boy can catch a fish, ride the rides, go to the circus, visit the center zoo, and have his hair cut. And if that doesn't tire him out, his mother can put him in the center's nursery school, where he can get paint on his shirt, see his friends, and wear himself out on the bars. Since these young adults seem to be able to outlast their children, they stash them away at a neighbor's house and go back to the center for more.
And now the little boomer is, quote, stashed away at a neighbor's house as the parents go back to the mall for more gaudy entertainment. And what we see here is that in many ways, the Silent Generation were the first generation to be marketed to directly as young adults and as teenagers. And there's a certain sense of entitlement that comes from this type of consumerism. The advertiser tells you that you, the 21-year-old or the 18-year-old or the 16-year-old or the 12-year-old even, are important. That your opinion matters, that your tastes and your preferences are going to be pandered to. So one sees also where the narcissism and the entitlement of the boomer very likely came from. The very source of their dissatisfaction in their souls, the plastic conformity of consumerism, which they railed against, was also the origin of their selfishness. But unlike the cynical Gen Xers who came after them, the boomers had been taught, as we have seen here, to be hopeful for the future, to be optimistic. And so their dissatisfaction with conformity, their yearning for individualism, also came laced with a naive idealism, which manifested itself in the hippie nonsense of the 1960s. Of course, the music of that time was made not by boomers, but by the artistic Silent Generation, who, while conformist in their everyday lives, showed their more rebellious side in the art and the culture they produced. They taught their kids this streak of rebelliousness while taking everything their own parents had taught them for granted. After all, the Silent Generation would only have a dim memory of the hardship from their childhoods, and most of the world they had known were the good times. In many ways, it was the Silent Generation who created the ideals and the products which were directly marketed to the boomers. And then, when they were older, in positions of power, it was the Silent Generation who failed to protect and defend our institutions from insurrection by boomer radicals. Of course, they were always going to indulge the boomers. Why break the habit of a lifetime?
To give these serious young adults the substance they want, to build a durable relationship with each reader, Redbook edits for one person at a time.
As with the slogan of Redbook magazine's national campaign for easy living, the Silent Generation wanted an easy life. In many cases, they took the path of least resistance. They were only too happy to fit in with the picture painted for them by their parents, helping out in fulfilling their prescribed roles. They registered discontent only in a passive-aggressive way through art and popular culture. They were not going to stand up directly to the great war heroes of their parents' generation. And in fact, you can see the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, for example, you can see that the Greatest Generation collectively gave the rock bands of the 1960s a pat on the head and a well done. In a strange way, the Silent Generation's music acts of the 1960s were not all that rebellious. They got the seal of approval from the GIs. They did what the Silent Generation did best. They appeased. They appeased both their parents and their children. To take the example of the Beatles, you do not sell 585 million records in less than a decade if you're not in some way ratified by the establishment. Perhaps this is why, by the 1970s, genuinely boomer artists such as David Bowie were writing lines like, "And my brother's back at home with his Beatles and his Stones. We never got off on that revolution stuff. What a drag. Too many snags." Or how about Joe Cocker? "London Calling. Now don't look at us. Phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust." One has to remember that the boomers were mostly young teenagers in the 1960s, and so of course they would come to reject some aspects of the prepackaged revolution that their parents' generation was trying to give them. Unlike the Beatles, acts like David Bowie or The Clash were perfectly prepared to shock and appall the sensibilities of Middle America and Middle Britain. The boomers, while undoubtedly selfish and narcissistic, were never the appeasers that their parents were. For the damage that they caused when they were adults, join me next time when I'll be looking at what made Generation X the way they were. Now get out.
Writing for young adults, Red Book's editors have to keep learning and analyzing. Without too much crystal ball gazing, Red Book's editors have to keep an eye to the future.
Are you going to the dance tomorrow night? Yeah, my children are over.
There is a whole new generation coming, soon to be young adults. A bigger than ever market of people who have a history of their own, who remember all the way back to Eisenhower, who probably never saw their mother use a ringer, think automobiles are household appliances, and have reserved seats on the next rocket to leave the Earth.